Welcome to another season of the NHL Executive Suite. I'm Deb Placey. Excited for another NHL season. It's the seventh for Jim Neal as the general manager of the Dallas Stars. And it's always on your bio, 15 years as the assistant GM in Detroit. We'll talk about that. But you were also a terrific player. We can't forget about that. So thanks so much for doing this.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And like I said, it is a great time of year, starting the season off, and a great place to be up in Traverse City here.
So let's start with your playing days. We'll do a little bit because anyone who knows you, you're so affable and a gentleman, and you see pictures of you when you played and you have teeth knocked out and blood running down your face, and you had 854 penalty minutes and 524 regular season games. What is that side of you?
Well, I was a big, you know, as a player, I had to play hard. That was my style. But I was a big, and always been this way, is to treat people the right way. And it would drive me crazy when I'd see somebody taking advantage of somebody. And so I wanted to be a good teammate, and that was kind of my role in the team. And just played hard and got involved in things, and things happen.
It's pretty incredible to think, though, the way, you know, life is, and the, you know, the way fortunes can turn. You were drafted by the Blues, and even though you didn't play in St. Louis a long time, you met your wife there early on, started dating, and how different life would be if you hadn't been drafted by St. Louis. I mean, if it had been Toronto or Boston or a different team, how different your life would have been.
Yeah, no, it's amazing where our journeys take us. And, you know, I've been so blessed that way. And you meet great people everywhere you've been. You know, I've been traded a few times, and everybody says, where's your best city? They're all great cities. Because there's great people everywhere. And as you mentioned, in St. Louis, able to meet my wife. And here we are 35 years later.
Now, did you meet her in a bar?
It was, yeah. We went to Jamie Baker and I. Jamie played for the U.S. Olympic team. He was with St. Louis, too. We went out to go to a place and went there.
I'll call it a pub.
Yeah, pub. Yeah, might be better. This wasn't the place we went to. We went to another place. And we said, we're on the way back home, and he said, let's stop at this other place we've kind of gone to. And we stopped there, dropped in. It was empty, and there happened to be two ladies sitting there. And we started playing this little reflex game that they had on the bar. And they were kind of sitting next to us, and we said, hey, why don't you guys try this? And next thing you know, we started talking, and here we are now, 35 years later. We started dating. I brought her out to a game. I still remember, actually, that we laugh about this too, the first game, brought her to a game. And in that game, we talked about my history as a player. I got in a fight, got beat up pretty bad in the fight, was all scratched up, and I came out to meet her after, and she just sat there and said, what am I getting myself into here? but it all worked out. I ended up getting traded. It would have been, our first date was January 7th, and I got traded in February that year at the trade deadline. And so we really were dating for about 6 weeks and got traded up to Vancouver. But we slug it out. She was going to college, so we didn't see each other much during the next 3 years, and here we are.
I remember seeing you in Vancouver, pictures or video, and it was the Star Trek era, right?
Yeah, that was those jerseys, the V uniform, yes, yeah.
And how did you manage long distance?
Well, it was different back then because cell phones were just starting to come in. They really didn't have cell phone service back then. So we just long distance. And then there's another great story that goes with that. We were planning our wedding. And my wife, she has three other sisters, and they had one phone in the house. And now her sisters, they all sound alike. And so I always had to be careful whenever I'd call, and we'd start talking. You wanted to be careful. And their sisters are always pulling pranks. So we're planning our wedding. I'm on the phone late at night with her, and all of a sudden the operator comes on and says, excuse me, Mr. Neal, can you please hang up? It's an important call. Well, we figured it's her sisters trying to get her off the phone so they can use the phone.
Like, remember the click-in? Used to click-in.
Yeah, click-in, yeah. And the operator came on, please get off the phone. There's an important call. We thought it was her sisters trying to get her off the phone so they can use it. So I said, no, we won't get off the phone. We keep talking 5 more minutes. The operator comes back on. Excuse me, Mr. Neal, please get off the phone. It's Mr. Harry Neal, and he would like to speak with you. I said, Becky, I'd just been traded.
You knew.
Well, it's 11 o'clock at night. Why is the general manager calling me? And that's when I got traded from Vancouver to Boston.
You were on the move again.
On the move again, yes.
So growing up in Hanna, Alberta, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What was life like growing up for you? And what was life like for the Nils in Hanna, Alberta?
Well, a great family life, great mom and dad, brother and sister, big family there, small farming town, about 2,000 people, and we grew up in that small town, loved it. I remember playing road hockey, winter times, the snow, snowmobiling. We lived, it's 2,000 people, so we'd get on snowmobiles, you'd go anywhere you want. It's a wide open countryside. So grew up there, loved it, had a great family life, and had the passion for hockey. You know, up in Canada, you can play hockey, you know, for about 8 months on the frozen ponds and everything else, and loved doing that, and away it went.
Anybody who describes you or talks about you as the family guy, and not that cartoon or that snarky animated cartoon. Let's talk about some of your current players. Ben Bishop, Tyler Seguin, they all say you're a father figure. You're not afraid to put your arm around one of the guys. You know, where did that all come from?
Yeah, I think I ought to give credit to my parents, my upbringing. I had a great family life, strong values, do things right, proper way. And I just think that's... It doesn't matter whether you're in the hockey business or what you're doing. It's important to treat people right. And I don't think we have enough of it in the world. I don't think we spread enough love. And I think we need more of that. And why is that any different in our hockey world? That doesn't mean we're not competitive. We're going to play hard. You know, some of my best friends are guys I played against that I couldn't stand playing against. And we used to battle each other. Laurie Boschman. We used to just go after each other. I got traded to Winnipeg. We played together, and now we're best friends. So there's a respect there, and but it's about treating people right. And I think it just pays off down the road. You know, everybody's got something going on in their life, and it might be something great, or they might be down in a deep valley somewhere, and let's try to help them out.
So you've certainly had a lot going on in your life. Let's talk about the battles that your family has waged, and we'll talk a little bit about Becky. And she found out very early on, she was diagnosed with cancer. Talk about a journey.
Yes. Yep.
Tell us how that started for you as you look back on it now all these years later.
We had just moved to Detroit. I just became the assistant GM. And I remember her getting up one morning and said, something's not right here. We need to go get checked. And we went and checked, and it was breast cancer. And we had a young family, and that started the journey. It's 23 years ago. And when I talk about doing things right with people, I learned a lot of that from my wife. She's been just a great role model. The way she's handled things, you know, with the family, with her illness, the ups and downs, not knowing where it was going to go. And here she is still today. We got three grandchildren now, and there's no better person.
What was it like for you to watch her be the one who physically didn't feel well and was struggling and battling? Did you sometimes feel helpless?
Yeah, you do. Now, that's where I think our faith, my wife's strong, strong Christian, and I've learned from that. And I'm the same way now. And I was a late comer to that part of my life, and now I'm as strong as ever. And to watch how she has managed herself, the family, the kids, people around her, it's not a feel sorry for me situation. She's there to help other people, and she knows that's God's calling. And she's the people she's touched because of what situation she's in and how she's turned that into positive have been just an amazing thing to watch.
Religion, I know, has been such a big part of her healing and recovery. Religion can be so divisive, you know, in our country, especially in these days. You said you were a little bit of a late comer to it. How do you see religion and having helped your family and the way that it's seen maybe by young people today or politicians or that kind of thing?
You know, I for me, it's pretty simple. I never grew up, I went to church and that, but I never read the Bible. The Bible was a foreign book to me. And all of a sudden, I started to understand it, started to read it, and it's our foundation. And the biggest thing that the Bible talks about is, you know, love your neighbors, you love yourself, and spread the love. And that's what I've got out of it. That's where I see things. And that doesn't mean you still got to make decisions, the right decisions. And the Bible talks about that. It's having the right foundation. And that's important in anything you do in life. And whether I'm in hockey or dealing with my children or somebody else, try to have those same values. And that doesn't mean that I have struggles too. I'm no different than anybody else. I have good days. I make probably wrong decisions at times, but I know that you got to get back to where the right place is.
Well, you're not afraid to make the tough decision. About 5 minutes after you went to Dallas, you traded for Tyler Seguin. It was like a 7-player blockbuster deal. What I didn't realize was that you had a relationship with Tyler prior to that.
Yeah, I was fortunate in Detroit. Tyler played in Plymouth Whalers. I was about 10 minutes from my house, and so saw him play as a junior in Plymouth. Got to, you know, see him play there. Just being around the rinks, you kind of get to know him, you know, asking people about him, knew a couple of his friends. So I knew who he was as a person, definitely knew who he was as a player also. And we were very fortunate to be able to get him to Dallas.
What do you remember about making that deal?
You know, it was tough for both sides. You know, Peter Shirelli in Boston. I was fortunate, you know, we live in a cap world. And I knew they were in a cap situation. They're going to have to do something. We're seeing more and more of this. You know, the cap has changed the business. And they had to make some tough decisions. And we're just fortunate to have the right mix of players, the right draft picks to be able to make the deal. And I know it was tough for Peter. And I know Louis Erickson went there. Riley Smith went there. So he had some good players back that played very well for him. And in the end, it's a deal that worked out for both sides.
So that was your signature move when you first got to Dallas. Let's back up a little bit, because you did stay in Detroit 15 years as assistant general manager before taking that job. You had lots of offers. Let's talk about why it took you so long to take your first GM's job. It was clearly your choice.
Yeah, I was, you know, we talked about my wife's situation. It had a little bit to do with that. There was just not the right timing. You know, she's going through medical situations. I just thought, you know, is it the right time to move with the family? And sometimes, you know, my goal is to be a general manager, but sometimes you got to put family first, and that was important for us. And then the other part of it is, and I'm fortunate this way, I had some great people to learn from in Detroit. You know, Jim Devolano, Ken Holland, Scotty Bowman, Mike Babcock, you know, great people to learn from. And I look back now, if I would have got some of the jobs I was looking at 15 years ago, I may not be sitting here right now. Because we all think we're ready for it. But until you sit in that seat and have to make decisions, you know, with ownership, with coaches, with players, with contracts, with people, there's tough decisions to be made. And I may not have been ready. And I thought I was ready. But looking back, it was the best thing for me to stay there.
Would you say you're a decisive person? Like if you're at a restaurant and ordering something off the menu, do you make quick decisions? What's your way of going through those?
Yeah, no, I like to sit back and kind of analyze, and I'll make that decision quick when I have to, but I want to make sure I check all the boxes off first. I like to slow it down. I like things to go fast, but I know I got to slow it down. And so I've learned that. I guess that's what they call experience.
Yes.
Over the years, so I've finally learned that. But I like to sit back, analyze. I consider myself very organized, and I just want to make sure the ducks are all in order.
Jumps off the page, the players that you all drafted in Detroit, though, over the years. And so if you just look at Pavel Datsyuk and Henrik Zetterberg, I mean, it's been talked about many times. Pavel was sixth round, 171st overall. And I've heard you say, well, if we knew he was going to be that good, we wouldn't have even waited that long. First of all, what did you see in him? He came first. What did you see in him? What do you remember about the first time you saw him play?
Well, he had, and I remember Håkan Andersson, who's the guy, our scout over in Detroit and over in Sweden at the time that went saw him play the first time, said he's got Igor Larionov's mind. And we had Igor on our team at that time. And anytime you got a player that can think that way, there's something special about him. So we went and saw him play. It's funny. You look back. I remember we drafted him and we sent him. We didn't bring him over the first 2 years, I believe it was. So he stayed in Russia, and we had to make a decision whether to sign him or not. And I remember Kenny Holland and myself looking at it and saying, "Do we sign him or not?" And another team had actually called and said, "You know, we'd like to make a trade, and it'd be this guy, and Datsyuk." And it was a pretty good trade. So we thought,
what was the team?
I believe it was Anaheim. It was a pretty good trade. And so we sat there and thought, you know, what should we do? So we went and saw Pavel play a few times, and we'd go see him play, and he wouldn't do much. And then so then Kenny would go see him play, and I'd go see him play. We'd take turns, and we were kind of on the bubble. And then finally I went to a tournament to watch him play, and he lit it up. And I remember calling Kenny and saying, "Kenny, I don't think we should trade him. I think we better give him a chance." And so that's when we signed him. Now, even as much as we thought he was going to be good, I remember his first contract had an out. If he wasn't on the team after November, he was going to go back to Russia in that. So we didn't know where he was going to fit in, but that's the year, I believe that's the year we signed Brett Hall, and they played together, him and Boyd Devereaux, and they just had a fit as a line, and away they went.
Amazing. If you look at the numbers, just in terms of goals, I think he only played 82 games one season. Yeah. In his entire NHL career. He had an 80 game or an 81 game, but only once. What was it about him that made him so special in terms of what he was able to produce?
Well, he had his hockey sense and his skill level was elite. But I think the thing people forget, people see these stars and they think, well, they have it. He worked at it. I remember watching him in practices and he'd sit for half an hour just doing one little drill with a stick, just over and over and over. And I still remember one time watching him. He was behind the net and he was flipping pucks up off the boards, off the glass, trying to get it to go over top of the net the other way and stuff. So I said, what are you doing there? He said, sometime in a game, I want to try that. He said, I'm going to be covered by two defensemen. I want to try to find a way to get the right angles. And that's the type of mind and the commitment that he had. He'd go on the ice and it was just same drill over, 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 over. And worked hard. His condition, he was stronger than most people realized. And like I said, he was committed to being the best player.
Did he speak much English when you first met him?
No, I remember picking him up at the airport. That's another great story. I picked him up at the airport. I had my two kids with me. I said, we're going to go pick up. And my kids, that was my son and my oldest daughter at the time, they would have been about maybe 13 and 11.
Okay.
And so picked them up at the airport. Pavel at the time was still pretty young the first time we brought him to development camp. That's when we brought him for development camp. So he's probably about 5'10 and 140 pounds,
wow,
soaking wet. And he wouldn't make eye contact. You know, he was kind of slouched over. And that's kind of, you know, how he comes from a far point of Russia, kind of. And that's kind of, you know, he was very reserved, to put it that way. Didn't speak any English, none at all. And I remember my kids looking at me and saying, this guy's going to be an NHL player? Like, how's this going to happen? We brought him to development camp. In the first three or four days, he really, really struggled. He didn't like his sticks. His agent was calling us, get him better sticks, do this, do that. I remember him working out. We did some testing. He couldn't bench press 130 pounds.
Wow.
He might have been able to do it, but he wouldn't do it, put it that way. And we got him some new sticks, and about 6 days into camp, we started having scrimmages. Well, the light bulb went off, and he just started to dominate. We're like, who is this guy? All of a sudden, it just clicked. He took off, and you could just see his confidence, and away he went.
Wow.
And I still remember him. We stayed at a hotel, and about a mile down the road was a beautiful mall. And I remember leaving the rink and heading back home, and there he was, this guy walking with about 20 bags. And it was Pavel, and he was taking stuff back to First Family.
Wow.
You know, bless his soul. He had all these, you know, chance to, you know.
Shopping bags.
Shopping that could never do anywhere else. And a great man, a great family man. And I just love him. Whenever I get a chance to see him, you know, we always kind of connect in that, because him and I were kind of the first connections to North America, and just a special bond. And he's a good person, real good family man.
Think back to if you hadn't seen that game where he lit it up or made that phone call.
Yeah, you make a trade or something, you never know. And that's our business. You just never know. You don't know.
Do you have a couple that stick in your craw of a trade you didn't make or did make that you regret or wish you would change your mind on? Every day, never?
Yeah, be pretty well every day, probably. Yeah. No, it's funny because the more you're in this business, and this is going to sound kind of strange, the more you're in this business, the less you know. You know more, but knowing more kind of hurts you, because you've seen things happen. You've seen trades that turned out, and you've seen trades that didn't turn out. And they've all got different reasons for it, but there's no one reason you can say, well, you should just do that. I know people out there think, well, just you make this trade for this. It's not black and white like you think. It's not as straightforward. And, you go back to the draft, and we always go back with our scouts, go back 2-3 years in the draft and say, okay, let's go over our lists. Well, you look at those lists and you're like, oh my gosh, what was I looking at? But that's players. You're dealing with young men are 18. Some are developed in men, some aren't developed. Pavel Datsyuk, Henry Zetterberg weren't developed yet, and they become stars. And so you see examples of players that a small guy that made it, and you're like, okay, this next small guy's going to make it. But I've seen examples of small guys that didn't make it.
Right.
You go to the American League and the American League's full of them.
Right.
And vice versa. You see big guys that you're like, ooh, we got to have this big guy. They make it. And then you got another example out there of a big guy that didn't make it. And so the more years of seeing things, the more you've seen that can be good, and the more you've seen it can go bad. So it's almost, the more you've seen doesn't hurt you, but you got more knowledge that makes it harder to make decisions.
I totally understand that, because you start to compare it to what's happened before.
Sure, yes. And you got so many comparisons.
Right. it's not an easy job you have.
No, well, you know what? We have a great staff. I always kind of laugh because people say, well, you know, Jim Nail had a great draft, a bad draft. I really don't see the players much anymore. You know, my job now is to manage. And that's probably the biggest thing I learned becoming a manager is I was used to being the doer. I love to go to Russia, Sweden, go to junior games, see the players, and sit with the head scouts and make decisions. I don't do that anymore. My job is to hire good people, encourage them, and they're going to make me look good. And that's really my job now.
And did you learn that from Ken Holland?
Yes, I did. From Ken Holland, Jim Devolano. It's about hiring good people. And my job is to help manage those people, give them the best environment they can to work in, give them the best tools they can handle, be there to encourage them, give a little guidance. But in the end, I live down in Dallas. I can't be up in Windsor, Ontario, and Sault Ste. Marie watching games all the time. I got a team I got to watch now. I got an owner that I got to communicate with. I got a coach I got to communicate with. I got pro scouts, amateur scouts. I got an office staff. I got analytical staff. So my job is to manage those people now. And that's probably the biggest lesson I learned and probably the thing that saved me the most from becoming a GM, general manager.
Let's do Henrik Zetterberg, though. Don't want to leave him out because he also was even later, right, in terms of seventh round, 210 overall the next year. And I also was surprised to see, I hadn't realized, you also left him in Europe a couple years. He didn't come right to the Red Wings, which I wonder, and I'll ask you, would you not do that today? Are you forced to put him in your own system and need to have his diet a certain way and need to have him, you know, NHL ready or in your own system? What did you see in him?
Yeah, well, you know, we're talking about players in that and how some guys are ready, some aren't. And Pavel and Henrik, they weren't ready. They weren't mature physically. They weren't ready for it. When we saw, I think Henrik would have been 150 pounds soaking wet also. And he was another, I still remember, you know, first, it's not all me. We had a great scouting staff, you know, and Joe McTinnell, you know, Mark Leach, Håkan Andersson, Vladimir Havlui. These guys, they're the ones that go find these players. But I remember we were going to watch another player, actually, up in northern Finland. And there was Finnish, Swedish, Russian, and I think Czech teams up there. And went up to watch, it was a guy that was drafted by the Islanders. And we went up to watch him. We really liked him and stuff. And kept watching these games, and we kept looking at each other saying, boy, this little guy here, boy, he's just always on the puck, just always on it. You know, we got to keep an eye on him. And so we watched the rest of the tournament, and then Håkan was going back to Sweden. I said, Håkan, make sure you keep an eye on him. And he did, and we were fortunate. I think that year, I don't think we had a pick until the fifth or I think we had a pick in the fifth round. He was a sixth round, if I'm correct. Is he sixth round or fifth?
Seventh.
Seventh?
210 overall.
Yeah, we didn't have a pick until the sixth round that year. Wow. I think that was in Boston. We had traded away, you know, we were a contending team, and we were going for it, and so we had traded away all these picks. And
that's a lot of picks to trade away.
And I remember going to the draft, and bless his soul, Jimmy D. Jimmy D grew up in a drafting environment. That was his success with the Islanders and with Detroit. And we went to the draft. I don't think we picked to the fifth round that year. And I remember Jimmy D sitting there saying, you know, why are we even here? You know, because you go through the first round, the second round, the third round, the fourth round. You're just sitting there and all these players are ticking off. And I looked at him and said, yeah, I don't disagree with you, but, you know, we got to try to find one player. And it turned out we took a flyer on Henrik Zetterberg, and here we are. And, you know, those two players probably saved the organization because we're at a stage where the Steve Yzerman and Shanahans were towards the end of their careers. And these two young men came along and gave us another shot in Detroit. You know, Nick Lidstrom was still in his prime. These two young guys came along, and they took over from the Steve Yzermans and these guys.
Well, the podcast is called the NHL Executive Suite, and you're an executive, and you just mentioned two players that are now GMs, your competition. Let's talk about them. Did you, Brendan Shanahan and Steve Yzerman, you lead us right to it. Did you know Steve was going to be this good of a general manager when he was a player?
Yes. Yeah. Steve just had that mind. He was always asking questions. You know, why'd you guys do this? You know, he wanted to know why, you know, why did you make this trade? Why'd you send this guy down? So we'd talk about it. And when he retired, you know, a lot of guys retire and they're like, the expectation is just, you know, I'd like to do this and let's just kind of go do it. Steve was like, hey, I want to dig in with you guys. When you're going down to Grand Rapids, I want to come ride with you. And he'd sit at the games and watch the games and ask questions there. You know, why is this young player not playing, or why is this guy playing, or why was this guy sent down? He'd ask questions. And the best conversations are when you're in a car and you're talking hockey for 2.5-3 hours. And that's what we do. We drive down to Grand Rapids, watch the game, drive back, and the questions would... Well, that's all we did was talk hockey.
Steve Yzerman did it the right way. Brendan Shanahan also took his time and actually went to work for the league, worked in player safety, did some other things. Did you think he would go the general manager route, the personnel route?
Yeah, I think eventually he would, yes. Yeah, yeah. A little bit different than Stevie, but...
How's he different?
Stevie is, and I guess say this the right way, he's just focused. Stevie's a very focused guy. And Brendan's, I'd say, more worldly, I guess. And you knew he'd maybe try different things, see where he fits in. But you knew that he had the mind and whatever it takes to get into those type of positions. And, they both know hockey very well. They're both successful, and they've carried that on.
You know, it's funny. I'm just thinking this. It popped into my head as we're talking. So many of these, the most successful players in the league over the years, they're not going into coaching. That all of these big stars are going into the front office, Marty Brodeur, right. Even on the business side. Why do you think that is? They're not going into coaching.
That's a good question. Coaching is a tough job. I don't think coaches get enough respect. It is a tough, tough job. You're dealing with 20 to 25 players. They're all elite players. They've all been the best everywhere they came from. They're wired. They wouldn't be here if they weren't driven guys. And you got to manage those people. And society's changed a little bit. The money's bigger. The expectations are bigger. I think the cap world has changed. Our game is so close now. There's no difference between 2015 and the 10th team. You're always going to have your 5 or 6 kind of elite teams, but they're not. I keep telling our team, we're all 3-4 wins. We're one win a month from being where you want to be or where you not want to be.
It's crazy.
It's one win a month. That's
everybody wants your job, though. They don't want to coach.
and coaching stuff. It's a tough. It's you're dealing and there's expectations on coaches, unfortunately, and that's they're the ones that the players take a little bit of the heat, and then it goes down to the coach, and it's a tough job. But it's other than playing, I coach a little bit myself. Other than playing, coaching is the best job there is. Other than playing,
it's rewarding.
It's rewarding. You're in the trenches. I did it down the minors for a couple of years. I was fortunate. Jim Devolano let me go down Adirondack into my career. I went down there and coached for a couple of years. It's the most rewarding thing. You're almost the next thing to being a player. Trouble is, you might have to move every 3, 4, 5 years, and that's tough when you start bringing in the family part.
So we're talking about the coaching and general manager. Scotty Bowman was both. What did you learn, you think, most from Scotty Bowman?
What I think the biggest thing was, first of all, an unbelievable mind, like his hockey mind. We'd be sitting, even if we're sitting here right now, he would bring up a name from whenever, and he would know it like that, bang, 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 who he played with, who he got traded to. Just an amazing mind and an amazing man. But the thing that impressed me the most with Scotty Bowman was how he changed. He was willing to change. Mm. Now, Scotty Bowman is probably the most successful coach ever, if not the one of them. And you look at the generations he went through. You're talking the 60s, the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. Well, we're wired that we believe this is how we do things. I'm not going to maybe change. This was successful. I'm going to do it this way. Well, he knew he had to change. The players were changing. I saw him do that in Detroit. We had a certain type of team, a certain type of characters on the team, and he could have stuck to his old ways. He realized, I got to handle this player a different way. So he would change. And that's what impressed me the most is how he's changed with the times, and he continues to do that. And that's pretty impressive. It's not easy to do when you've been successful to say that, I'm going to be open-minded about this.
Very, very.
It's not easy to do.
Yeah, very impressive that he was able to do that. It's always fascinating to me to ask personnel gurus who, men and women who are really good at personnel. What are you looking for? You're going to sit down in Finland. You're going to sit down in a rink in Grand Rapids. What are you looking for?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's, first of all, you got to have the skill. There's got to be a certain skill level. But in the end, hockey sense to me is a big thing. If you got hockey sense, you're going to find a way to play. Doesn't matter whether you're 6'4" or 5'2", you're going to find a way to play. So hockey sense, got to have the basic skills, got to be able to skate a little bit. You got to be able to handle a puck and all this. But to me, the hockey sense, number one. And then you start to get in. The thing that defines the great players is that character. what, you know, that's, it doesn't matter anything in life. And now the trouble is you're dealing with 18-year-old kids, and how do you define that? I've got three of my own kids, and when they're 18, I didn't know where they were going. I couldn't figure them out. So here we are. We're looking at kids 10, 15 times a year. We're trying to figure out where they're going to be in 5 years. That's the tough part of the business, is who are they going to be in 5 years?
What bells go off, I guess, positive or negative when you're talking to some of them, that you think this is a go, or this is a bit of a warning sign?
I would say you got to be very careful both ways. You can have some guys come in and they're salesmen. The kids nowadays are so worldly. It's amazing. We go to the combine in Buffalo, and I'm just amazed. These kids walk in. I look at myself when I was 18, walking in a room full of a bunch of scouts and executives, and them drilling me on questions. I would have been rattled. These guys come in. They've played around the world, most of them. They've played against all the best players, most of them. They're so worldly. They're not intimidated. They're very polished isn't the word, but they're very experienced already for their age. And it's just amazing. I'm amazed, these young men. When we do our interviews in Buffalo, I can't say I've had a bad interview. 90% of the kids are just, I'm like, wow, these guys, they got it figured out. And so that's the toughest part of the job. That is tough. Yeah.
Your players, the other day, we're talking to them in preparation for the season. We're giving you credit for defusing the situation and this crazy thing that happened with Jim Leitz, where he came out and said that your best players were playing like blankety blank. How did you handle that?
It was a test. It's not who we are and not how we want to be represented. And Jim Leitz and I are very good friends. We got a great relationship. It goes back to Detroit days, actually. And I think that's something Jim, he said what he... The message wasn't conveyed the right way. You know, I condoned it right. I don't condone that type of language. It's not how I want to operate. It's not who we are. And we had it brought up good discussions. The players did have to play better, but we were dealing with that internally. But that's the emotions of our business now. And like I said, we learned from it. We've moved on. And like I said, it's not something that it's not who we are and how we want to be represented.
Nothing's perfect, though. No organization ever escapes unscathed from something, right, during the year?
No, there's something going on all the time. That's, you know, it's like I tell people, it's like life. We got 25 players on our roster approximately at one time. You've got a staff of probably another 50 people. You've got another team in the America League somewhere. You know that there's going to be something going on with somebody, something in their life, and you got to deal with it. You just can't sweep it under the rug. You deal with it, you move on the best you can, and that's what you have to do.
Let's do a little bit on your current team and Joe Pavelski. Why is that the move for Dallas now?
Well, anytime you can add a player of the pedigree of Joe Pavelski, you got to look pretty serious at it. And when we found out that he was going to be possibly available, we started doing our research, you know, and once you meet Joe, you know why he is who he is. He's a first-class guy. Some guys just have it all together. He's got it all together. He's a good family man. He treats people right. It's all about the team. And then you add that in with his skill level, what he brings to the team, his commitment to the team, his work ethic. It's just his leadership skills. You can see why he's been so successful.
Your most recent coaching hire, and you haven't made that many. I mean, you've been stable, but out of the box, a different kind of hire?
Yeah, a little bit. I guess no pro experience, so there's always a little bit of that risk. But I got to know Jim going way back when I was scouting. He just had retired. And I remember he went to RPI. He was helping the coaching staff.
He'd retired as a player.
He retired as a player, right, yeah. And so he was starting to get into coaching. So I got to know him a little bit in RPI. I was in Adirondack days back then.
So that was a while ago.
It was a while, a long time ago. So I don't want to age ourselves, but yeah, a while ago. Got to know him there a little bit. And then you get to, you know, you meet people, you kind of follow them. And you're always, in my business, you're following people who's been successful. You know, not only are we scouting players, we're scouting, you know, who's the next up-and-coming coach. And I always, that's something we do with our scouting staff. They're always watching. I always ask them, who's the next up-and-coming junior coach? Who's the next up-and-coming college coach? You're always looking, you know, who's the next guy? Because somebody else is coming along. We know that. You know, who was Scotty Bowman, you know, 56 years ago? Who was Mike Babcock? They came from somewhere. And so I followed his career, and he had success everywhere he went. You know, he went to the U.S. Junior League, had success. Went to Denver, had great success. So we had Ken Hitchcock. We knew that was possibly going to be a short-term thing, and it was a great fit for us at the time, but we knew that, okay, now we had to take the next step. And so interviewed Jim, and just something about him. It was the right fit, and I still look – and what I'm impressed most with him is he knows how to deal, I guess, the newer generation. I told him this at our end of year meetings. We have the morning skates, and I'd go down there, and, you know, how's it going, and what's your game plan? And he'd tell me the game plan, and I'd sit there saying, ooh, I don't know if I totally buy into this, but I said, you know what? I've hired this guy. I've got to let him. That's what I hired him for.
Right.
If I want to coach, I'll go coach. But I've hired him to coach. So I'd let him do it. I'd walk out with my staff, and we'd kind of say, what's going on tonight? And I'd say, well, he's doing this, and I'm, you know, I hope it's going to work. It did work.
Wow.
And that's where I give him credit. He's got a great way to communicate with players. Players believe in what he's doing. He's got a great system. And I give him credit. He can deal with kind of the newer generation of players. He knows how to handle those guys, different than some older coaches might. And he's had success with it. So I give him a lot of credit.
Now, let me just ask you this. When he said what the game plan was, and you're inside thinking, oh, geez, I don't know if this is going to work. Do you tell him that, or you just...
No, I didn't know. I kept to myself. I said, yeah. You know what? I've hired him to do the job, and I've got to let him do this. Now, we discuss things. It's not like I'm just going to say, okay, yep. We discuss it, but then I said, good for you, and okay. You believe in it. Let's go with it. And so we'd be open about it and discuss it, but it was his decision, and I'm sitting there saying, I've hired him to be the coach. That's his job. Let's let him go do it. And it turned out for us. He did a good job. You know, we had a rough start. We had a lot of injuries early on. Our back. We used, I think it was 12 or 14 defensemen last year. I remember going into one game playing Nashville. We had five defensemen never played in the league before. And it's just like, I said, here we go.
Wow.
But we kept our head above water, got everybody back, and we're stronger because of it.
Yeah.
And right from the All-Star break, once we hit the All-Star break, Jim, he did a reset. And it clicked in. He kind of realized he had to learn the players too. You know, he's come from college. He knows Jamie Benn, but he doesn't. He knows Sagan, but he doesn't. And it took him, he started to understand who we were, how we got to play, and away we went. And from January on, we were a tough team to play against.
Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this.
No, it's an honor anytime. And you know what? We got a great game, great people, as you guys are. And I really enjoy this.
Thanks so much. Have a great year. Yeah. We'll check in with you.
Great. Thank you.
We will be keeping tabs on his Dallas Stars all year. They're definitely one of the teams to watch to come out of the Western Conference. So thanks to you so much for listening. And you can check out the other shows on our NHL Podcast Network. The Great One-on-One with Wayne Gretzky. If you've got a fantasy team, if you're a fantasy player, we've got NHL Fantasy on Ice. And Dan Rosen is always on top of what's going on. Everything you need to know from around the NHL is on NHL at the Rink. Until next time, I'm Deb Placey in the NHL Executive Suite.